Rafe, you were going to mention luck and the lucky episodes, and I think Wendy was going to come.
You have no idea. I'll try to be brief, but my daughter died, our marriage split, and it was my fault. I simply couldn't handle it, and my wife could, and I fell into the first pair of arms that would take me, and wound up marrying her, and it was not a great idea. It wasn't a great match. And, just after I got fired by CJOR in April of 1984, she told me that the income tax department was after her for income tax. I said, how much? She said, I haven't paid it for 3 years. And I can't believe this. Well, it turned out that not only was I out of job, the house was worth less than the mortgage was. And all of the credit cards were maxed out. I had no cash and no car or anything. But I decided, I don't want to sound like I'm a hero here, but I'm just going to tell you the story because it's all that melts into one head. I suddenly did sort of an assessment of myself and realized where I was. So I made arrangements with all my creditors and the tax department that I would pay them each of them $25 a month. Just didn't come close to even to the interest, but that I would do that, and I intended to pay it off in full. And in fact, I did, but it took me 7 years to do it. But marriage, of course, had suffered considerably because of this. And my wife and I decided to part, which was fine with me. And, she went on a cruise and apparently had an affair with the captain, which I didn't care about. This, you know, we'd long since forgotten about that part of the marriage. And so the marriage had now come completely apart, and it was just a question of moving out. We were both staying in the same house, separate bedrooms, etc., reasonably amicably. And I was leading a tour to Great Britain, you know, talk show host leads tour, right. That kind of stuff.
Yep.
And we had one going that was going to go to Britain and Wales and Ireland. And the station, knowing that I'd gone through some kind of tough stuff at home, told me to take an extra week off. So I did. And with my stepson, we went to Scotland and went fishing for a week. And then we came back. I had to meet the plane from Vancouver with all this group, none of whom I'd ever met. So I got out of the station, and off came these elderly people, says this not octogenarian, mm-hmm. and a tall, lovely-looking lady. And I just felt just knocked over when I saw her. And when we had the introductions, we got on the bus to go to downtown London, I said, my advice to you is not to go to bed now, but to stay up until, it's their time to go to bed so you can get into the swing of it. And I'll help you because I'll take a little off-the-cuff tour. I'll take you all down to St. Paul's a while ago, and then we'll walk back, et cetera, because I know London very well. So about a dozen did, including this lady. And we got down to the tube station, the Oxford Circus tube station, and she was having trouble making the ticket thing work. So I helped her got the ticket. And we sat on the tube, beside each other, the four stops, I think it is, from there to St. Paul's, during which time we each knew everything there was to know about the other's life. And to make a long story short, 4 days later in Exeter, I asked her to marry me. And she accepted.
And was she from Vancouver?
She was from Abbotsford. So it got to the night before she was coming back, and I realized I hadn't made any arrangements to meet her. So I knew where she was. I called her in Dublin, the Gresham Hotel. And we agreed that we would meet at the ABC restaurant just outside of Abbotsford. Right? I don't know the area very well. But anyway, we'd meet there. And she was getting in at 7:30, and as soon as she could get clear of everything, she'd meet me there. Well, I was there at 7, just in case the plane was early, and I had 11 long-stemmed red roses, 11 because I'd broken one, and I had 2 bottles of champagne, which I put on ice. And it became 8:30, 9, 9:30, and I thought, oh, Ray, what an idiot you've been. You know, this is not going to happen, you know. And I said, how the hell do I get back into the house, et cetera, et cetera. All of a sudden, there she was. And what had happened is she'd left her car at her estranged husband's place. I didn't know where else to leave it. And he'd come to pick her up with a dozen roses himself and try to make amends and put up a hell of a fuss, apparently. And I can't blame him. In any event, that's why she was late. And we went back to her apartment, and we sat out until about 4 o'clock in the morning just talking and drinking the champagne. And I moved in at that time, and when we were rid of our legal impediments on July 29th of 1994, I guess it was, we got married. And it's just a huge success. It's been a great love story, and it continues now, almost 20 years later, 19 years later. So she's the mainstay of this family.
And did you stayed with CJOR till 84? And
I got fired in the end of April 1984. And as I say, I was completely bust, more than bust. I was in my minus figures, with new ones coming out of the woodwork every day. You know, bank in Toronto. Dinged me for a loan that I'd signed for my son, and he got broke, and so they sued me. And I kept saying, look, if anybody puts me under, I go under for everything. It just is not in anybody's interest, because if I go bankrupt, nobody's going to get anything. Well, they didn't agree, so they took me to court, and I had a good friend of mine in Victoria who took the keys for nothing, and we won. But, you know, that was just part of the sort of egg roll that went through almost on a daily basis. And, it's a great character builder, I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. Great character builder. It's an awful feeling. We're lucky in a way, though. I could bring some money in doing some consulting and giving speeches and that sort of thing. So we got so that we could maintain ourselves, you know, and still pay these $25 a month. But it wasn't until 1994, I guess it was, before I was clear. It was no fun. And I didn't exactly have a careful person with the money even after we'd gone broke. She'd still come back with a new bed from Belfair, whatever the hell it is, which was going to cost us $10,000, which went back before it got there. I think I got that one ripped up, but you never knew what the next one was going to be. You know? And she's gone now. I shouldn't speak ill of the dead, I guess, but she would be the first to admit that she had no concept of how to run money, and I should have taken her back with that. That was my fault. But in any case, we don't want to talk about that.
So did the... I can remember you from the radio and was the salmon, the farmed salmon.
Yes.
And what? There you go.
That's a sea shepherd.
Sea shepherd.
Yeah.
How did you get into that
issue? Well, I went to work at the... After I told you how broke I was, I had and the luck started. I got a call from an old classmate of mine, Mark Sewell. He's on here. Marshall Lamb, we called him Mark, and he took me out to dinner and offered me a job at Campney Murphy, and I think it was $75,000 a year, which is not a hell of a lot compared to what I had beginning. It was a hell of a lot more than I was getting then, and I'm eternally grateful to Mark. He doesn't know just how much he restored my confidence, and I'd agree to do it, and we were to meet to iron out the details when friends of mine from London, Dick and Joanna Lillico, LILLICO, were out visiting, and we used to stay at their place. We were there, and they came and stayed here. And Grace McCarthy gave them a cocktail party and invited Patty and me to it. And there I met John Plewell, who was the PR guy for CKNW. There's never been one like him since, before or since. A fantastic PR guy. But anyway, what are you doing now, Rafe? And I said, well, I think I'm going to go practice law. And he said, could you come out to the station? Now, this was on a weekend, not on Monday. I'd like you to meet the program director. I said, well, I know him, Ted Smith. Well, I'd like, I've been talking about you to him. We'd like to meet you. So I went out to the station, and lo and behold, all the brass were in Ted Smith's office. And he said, it's not much, but we don't want to see you out of the business. And we're going to start a midnight till 2 o'clock in the morning show. And we'd like you to be the host of it. And we'll pay you $90,000, but you've got to supply your own producer, which meant that Patty was going to go to work as a producer. So now, all of a sudden, there was a little breathing room. I was still in terrible financial shape, but, you know, but at least I had a job. And well, I guess this gets into the CKNW, that we probably aren't ready to go there yet. But there we were. I was working with CKNW, and I was so proud. I got a bumper sticker with CKNW on it before you see Jack Robinson. I was just delighted. And, it was a great career. Ended badly, but it was a great career.
So it sounds like you've divided your time between law, politics, and radio.
Yeah, that's about right.
That's
You asked about how I got into the fish farming. Well, growing up here on the coast of B.C., you just know and understand all the wonderful things around you, and you don't pay much attention to them because you don't think anything's ever going to happen to them. But I'd had a lot of time spent on the water here and spent fishing and so on. My dad had a boat, and we cruised all up and down the coast. So I just loved it. And when I got into the legislature and into cabinet, there was a shuffle coming up. I think it was in the fall of 77, I think it was. In any event, I had become very angry with the Minister of Environment, Jim Nielsen, N-I-E-L-S-E-N, on some environmental matters. And the Premier shuffled the cabinet, which he's going to do anyway, and he made me Minister of Environment. And immediately I was faced with some issues. The first one was that the government was slaughtering wolves in the north to pacify the ranchers. They were very upset about uranium mining and so on at that time, and there were people rising up all over the province on that. And on my plate immediately was the Skagit River. I'll deal quickly with that. Under an agreement with BC in 1941, Seattle Light and Power, which is essentially the city of Seattle, had the right to raise the Ross Dam on the American side of the Skagit River. That would have flooded our side completely, had a huge lake, and so on and so forth. And I knew the people that had been fighting it, called the Ross Group, which stood for Run Out Skagit Spoilers. And they were right across the political spectrum. There was Tom Perry from the left, and there was John Fraser, considered a whole bunch of them. And I went to Premier Bennett, and I said almost these words exactly, Premier, I'm not the kind that threatens to quit if he doesn't get his way, but I'm going to tell you, this can't happen on my watch. It just can't. So he said, give me the details, and I did, and I gave him a memorandum of what it was, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he called me in, and he said, Rafe, I want you to go settle that. You're quite right, we can't let that happen. So so down I went, and we ran into a logistical problem, like the setting of the table when the North Koreans or the North Vietnamese and the Americans met. Who sits where and what? The mayor of Seattle would not deal with a mere cabinet minister. He insisted on dealing with the premier. The premier said, the protocol is pretty strong. I only deal with governors. I can't deal with a mayor of a city. So my young assistant, who's now retired, so that's how long this was, he worked out a deal that the mayor's brother was his executive assistant, Royer. Charles Royer, R-O-Y-E-R, was the mayor, and I forget the name of his brother. The deal was that we would meet in a room in Seattle City Hall that had joined the mayor's office, and the mayor would sit in there and he would listen, and he would send in notes, that sort of thing. Well, again, trying to make a long story short, we settled it. The Skagit River is still there. I remember very, very well going out there, not long after we'd made the deal, as ice officials could have been. I remember standing on the bank, fly rod in hand, and thinking, you know, Mayor, you've been an awful asshole in a lot of things you've done in your life, but not this one. This is one that you can handle. So I carried that into government. By that time, I carried that into my life generally. I suddenly became much more concerned about environmental matters. And so when I left radio and left politics and went into radio, I got very interested in a number of environmental matters, especially fish farms. And early on, the problem with the fish farms is they were escaping. Hundreds of thousands of them would escape. They couldn't breed with the Pacific salmon, but they would occupy their spawning grounds. And they're reds, they call REDDS. And fortunately, the wild salmon off their spawning grounds. So I started to raise hell about that, and I got kind of a funny story, I guess. The minister in charge of agricultural fisheries and food at the time was John Van Dongen, who's making noises up in the interior. Van Dongen gives the note "stubborn Dutchman" a whole new meaning, and he insisted to me that only three salmon had ever been found. Ever been found in BC waters. He was followed by the late Stan Hagen, came on the following week and said, "I got to tell you, my colleague John was wrong. There are only two have escaped, have found the rivers." So they became three fish Van Dongen and two fish Hagen for a while. I got out of with the professor of the University of Alberta was standing up to his neck in those rivers, scooping out Atlantic salmon. So in the midst of all this, I got a call from a lady named Alexandra Morton. And she had become concerned because the Indians near her area were saying there are far, far more sea lice in the water than ever before. The place is just full of them. And they said, "We think they're killing the baby salmon, the smolts of wild salmon." Well, they were. And she found that out, and she went to work. And we have stayed sort of partners in that cause right up into including today when I'm involved in a number of other environmental issues. She's a saint. She's just a wonderful, wonderful person. She's fought City Hall all the way. Governments have put every roadblock in their way. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans particularly have. We're going to charge her with illegal testing. And now they're suppressing evidence of disease that are in this. I mean, it's just an absolute horror story. You can't believe that people you put in power would do these sorts of things. One thing you notice if you're in my boots very quickly, the Vancouver Sun seems to give the fish farmers an op-ed article anytime they want it. And none of the media, not one, have ever said a peep about these things after all these years. And of course now, after that, I was asked to give a speech in, where was it? Port Coquitlam, I think it was, or Port Moody. There was a plan to get power from one of the tributaries, or three of the tributaries, to the Pitt River, and all of which were salmon-bearing, and they had local bull trout and so on and so forth. And the company was required to hold a public meeting and with government officials. Well, they held it in a place that I think it only held something like 100 people. The fire marshal was there before it got started, said, "This has got to go." So they were forced to do another one. They went to a school, and there was room for about 1,000 at the place. And when the hearing started, there were 1,000 in there, and there were probably 200 or 300 outside with loudspeakers. And I was asked by a man named Tom Rankin, who was head of an organization of Save Our Rivers, if I would speak at this, and I did. And after it was over, he asked if I'd want to work for them professionally, and I said, "Yes, that's fine," so I did. So we stayed on that hot and heavy right through the 2009 provincial election, where this old Socred campaigned for the NDP on this issue and on other issues. And, or have I got... No, that's right. The idea of these international power producers, IPPs, is that they put in not a dam, but a weir. and they don't interrupt the water flow at all, and they make private, they make power from BC Hydro. Well, everything I've said is an absolute fib. First of all, they're not weirs, they're dams. Secondly, they do dam them up at the time the fish are coming upstream, so they are in the way of them. Thirdly, they have to make power from BC, I should say it this way, BC Hydro is required to buy their power by law and by agreement with the companies. So that even when they don't need power, such as in the springtime, the spring runoff, they have to buy power from the private companies at double what the export price is, and at about 12 times as much as BC Hydro can produce the power themselves. And you're looking blankly, as most people do, because nobody could believe this. I mean, it is absolutely an unbelievable story, but that is the story.
Why was it a pure kind of... was it done for ideological reasons?
I think so. They're great believers in the Fraser Institute, and we can talk about that if we have time, but they are. There's absolutely no logical reason for it whatsoever, and they've now destroyed 75 rivers, and they hope to destroy about 600 of them by the time it's all finished. And it's an appalling story. It really is. I just, every once in a while, I shake my head and say, look, there's something here I'm not getting. But, you know, we're not talking 5 years ago, and it's just got worse. So I stayed with Tom's organization until about July, I guess, of that year, and then he just put too much money into it. He was tired, and I think we all felt that was very understandable. And working with me, with Tom, was a young filmmaker named Damian Gillis. And Damian and I got to know one another, and we decided we'd start a webpage ourselves to carry this on. And so we put together an organization called the Common Sense Canadian. The Common Sense referring to Tom Paine, not to citizenship, which, if you're interested, the website is thecanadian.org. And we started to put together people who would support us. You'd be, well, I invite you to Google it, and you'll see who the contributors are. And they're from all walks of life and all different political colors. And so that's what I've been doing pretty well now for the last 3 years. It involves a lot of public speaking, a lot of writing, and so on. And it's now morphed into a fight against the pipelines and the tankers. And that takes up more of our time now than the river situation does. And so we've been very much involved in that. And
this is the Enbridge.
Enbridge, and thereafter the tankers. So the problem with this issue is, Richard, it's not a question of taking risks. These things are certainties. There's no risk involved in the pipeline. They will absolutely burst from time to time, and many times. And the problem is made much worse by the fact that what they're carrying is dilbit, which is diluted bitumen, called bitumen. And this stuff is more tar than it is anything else. They have to put a bunch of chemicals into it as they ship it in order to make it, is viscous the right word, sufficiently thin that they can travel along the pipelines. And they at the same time, they have another pipeline going back, taking the chemical, and once they got the bitumen into the tankers, it takes the other stuff back. So I think probably the best example of why I say it's a certainty is in the last 5 years, I think I'm right on the years, Enbridge has had 831 oil spills out of their pipelines. Now, the biggest one they had is a rather well-known one now in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which happened in 2010, July 2010, and hasn't been cleaned up yet. They can't clean it up. And what happens is the bitumen, ordinary oil will float for quite a while, so you can raft it. It'll bring rafts closer and closer and closer and scoop it out. Within 15 or 20 minutes, the bitumen sinks. It only lasts for a little while the remainder of the chemicals are supporting, and then it sinks. And it goes down and becomes like marbles. It's not, you can't just sort of get a great bunch of it and scoop it out. It's like little marbles. They roll all over the river. they destroy the fishing, destroy the use of the river. The Enbridge pipeline goes about 1,170 kilometers, and it goes through two mountain ranges, the Rockies and the Coast Range, and two valleys, what they call the one in between the two mountains, I can't remember now. The second one, they get into the Great Forest, Great Bear Rainforest. And they cross about 700 rivers, most of which are either fish-bearing or contribute to rivers that are fish-bearing, putting very much at the threat the Skeena River and its fish population. So the whole thing, it really is a nightmare. And you've got people in Canada saying, what's happened to her? Barbara Yaffe in the Vancouver Sun, something, we can't become just one great big park. You know, we must do this and must do that. And as I say, it's a very, very, very simple proposition. The pipelines will leak. They will leak substantially, and so will the tankers. And the federal Department of Environment, which is not known for its environmental moves very often, has said that the tankers, no matter what safety measures you take, there'll be a 1,000-liter spill every 5 years and a 10,000-liter within 10 years. And those things, you can make bet on them and make book on them, and they're going to happen. So, you know, I hate to get into the money argument because it's a bad one. I'll tell you why in a moment. But BC is allowing this to happen for bugger all to them. You know, if we're getting billions of dollars a year, I suppose there'll be some argument. But money is a very bad thing to get into in an argument. It happened years ago when people were talking about the fisheries. And the question was asked, well, do we make more money out of commercial fishing or the sports fishing? That masks the real issue, which is, do we want to give up what is British Columbia's trademark, what native bands have fed on all these years, what sports fishermen like says, do we just give that away for money? And the answer I have is no amount of money that will do it. Now this is with the pipelines, tankers, it's even worse than that. And it's an absolute dead certainty you're going to kill off your fish and so on. So that's what Damien and I are up to as much as anything right now, and it's pretty much a full-time job. I do a lot of writing for them and speaking, etc. There you have it.
It seems to me, but I mean, as a historian of BC, it seems like one thing we have here is a lot of land, you know, a huge territory, and it's very easy to take advantage of it, to think, well, we've got... There's an endless frontier. We can just take
always another valley to log. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was a Rocky Mountain Trench, I was thinking, between the two ranges. But let me just go back to that for a second. What in the hell could they do if they had a spill anywhere along that area? Hmm. You could never get any heavy equipment in to help the spill. And if you did, the Kalamazoo River and others show that you can't do a hell of a lot about it anyway. But you know, to say, well, we're going to have a safe passage of oil through the Rocky Mountains, the Rocky Mountain Trench, over the Coast Range, and down through the Great Bear Rainforest. I mean, it boggles imagination how anybody could even think that sort of thing. And yet there are loud people that are saying, oh, no, we've got to do this.
Well, it's certainly meeting a lot of opposition, Aboriginal and environmental and
isn't it
political.
Interesting, though, that you've not heard a peep out of either Michael Smith or Vaughn Palmer on this for the whole time? Not a peep. Not a peep on fish farms. Not a word on the rivers. This is the state of your media. And I gave one of them hell one day on, I think it was in the speech. I don't know. In any event, Wayne Moriarty, who was the executive editor of the Vancouver province, phoned me up in great rage, etc., and finally said, do you believe that I tell my columnists and my reporters what to write? I said, well, you don't have to. You know, it's not rocket science. They're not going to get printed. If they don't get printed, they're not going to get paid. And if you take a look at the way the press dealt with the NDP in the 90s and the Socreds before then, I go back to the days of Marjorie Nichols and Jack Webster and on they went. And you know, you were hit with everything but the ring post every day you went to work. And take a look at what it's like now. I mean, it's just, what can we say? Well, I'll say it. It's a corporate blowjob is what it is. Mm-hmm. They just give in to the companies all the way. And the companies, of course, are generous with their political donations and so on. And we reached, I think, the sort of the moment of truth in British Columbia. What are we going to be? So there we are.
So how would you describe your politics? I was thinking when you were talking, there's a bit of the red Tory, or are you a pragmatist or a free thinker? Or,
well, that's a good question. I'm called upon to answer that quite frequently. I don't think that I have changed very much since I was in government. I think I perhaps expanded my environmental interests and concerns, but I always did have those concerns. I have, for the last 3 years, supported the NDP with considerable misgivings. I might say considerable misgivings. But I've sort of taken the view this way. If a government goes into office and completely screws up the economics, you can fix it. A new government comes along and they fix it. They take time, they take pain, but they fix it. If you lose your rivers, and you lose your inlets, and you lose your salmon, they're gone forever. So, how am I going to vote for something that may screw everything up economically, but will look after the environment, mm-hmm. or go to the person that's going to keep the books right and not give a damn about the environment? And incidentally, keeping the books right is rather interesting because NDP, when they were in, they doubled the provincial debt. Since then, the Liberals have tripled it, mm-hmm. based on a higher base, of course. Mm-hmm. And so that argument is very difficult for the Liberals to maintain, but they're a business-oriented government center. But anyway, you ask about me, I don't think I've changed. I don't think people that know me well think. I was called Red Rafe a lot of the times when I was with the Socrats. And I think if you look at the record I had in consumer and corporate affairs in terms of left and right, and then you look at my record in the environment, I think you would say, no, this guy might have accentuated some parts of his beliefs, accent, I suppose. But basically speaking, if you looked at what he did when he was in government, you could see where he was going to go if he got out of government and got into the situations that are now. So that's where we're at.
Well, thank you. And we usually ask what are the big changes you've seen in your time in.
Well, I think I've done that.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing we ask is who do you recommend? But we've also done that. Who else shall we talk to?
On my list.
You mentioned a few names, but maybe...
Most of them are pretty interesting. I'll tell you one guy who's extremely amusing and a good interview is Hamish Cameron.
Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about him.
Well, he worked for Bullhauser, Tupper's, and then was for a long, long time. He's probably retired now. You know, we're all in our 80s or nearby. I'm trying to think of who else. The best ones are dead, of course. So many of the ones that I would have... I guess the ship disturbers die more quickly. Look down this list, I just... Yeah, Ron Bray's dead, Peter Butler's dead, Patsy Byrne is dead. But I mentioned Klein.
Yeah.
Oh, they're all dead or a long way away. Oh, Holland, right? He's gone. Holmes is gone. Bob Hutchison's on the bench, so he's probably retired by now.
Jim McCauley. Jim McCauley would be one. William McKenzie. Yeah, he'd be a good interview. That's about all I can think of, Richard, from the group, is because, you know, so many of us are gone. And so many of the people that I would, you know, you interviewed Tom Berger, of course. So.
Yep.
Maybe Tom Braidwood, I don't know.
Okay. Right, well, thank you very much.
You're all done, right? Okay.
Well, I think so, unless, Graham, you've got some...
sorry, I talked too much, I'm sure. You get me on these.
No, that was just exactly what we wanted.